Is the volume good for everybody? Is it too loud in the front? My aspiration here is to give the most boring presentation that I have ever given. Usually when I am speaking with comrades in this room, I'm talking about strategy, about current struggles. Today, the idea is to talk about something that informs those struggles, which is anarchist history and historiography. Historiography is the practice of writing history. It's the questions that come into play when you think about how to approach the concept of history. What would be an anarchist historiography? Is it just history written by anarchists? You know, like, is anarchist justice whatever justice anarchists do? Is anarchist food whatever food anarchists eat? Anarchist historiography would be something more than this. It would have to be participatory and horizontal and inclusive. Not a great man theory of history, but a way of understanding events that sees all of the participation, all of the different factors that contribute. A way of approaching history that equips people to bring about their own liberation. A way of understanding history that is not determinist, but brings us into contact with our agency. And a way of approaching history that enables us to counter false narratives about anarchists, false narratives about social movements, false narratives about ourselves and our collective potential. One of the reasons I wanted to do this here in Saint-Emier was to meet other history enthusiasts like myself, like ourselves, and we're hoping that once we've done a little bit of talking, others in the room can introduce themselves and the history that they're studying, for the sake of creating a participatory and horizontal network of remembering, of memory. And so that network and that remembering can inform all of the struggles that we participate in. And this is actually becoming, in some ways, easier today as more and more archival materials end up on the internet, and things that were previously just reserved for academic scholars, these questions are now things that we can address ourselves to. And my hope is that that there will be people in this room who know better than I do, even about the things I'm talking about. So again, this is an effort to fact check my own research with you. What I'm going to do for my part of the presentation, each of us is going to give an example from our historical research. And what I will try to do from my part of the presentation is to debunk a myth, to dispel a myth about Mikhail Bakunin that has never been debunked in 170 years. Here, we can go ahead to the next slide. This is Mikhail Bakunin in the year 1849. This is a depiction of him that's in Budapest, but it's from the year 1849. This is an example of how history often skews the way we see the past. When you think of Bakunin, you don't think of this picture. You think of the famous picture of Bakunin. In this way, we have this habit of seeing historical figures as sort of static spirits, you know, rather than people who, like ourselves, are in a process of development. So the story that I'm going to tell takes place in Dresden during an uprising in 1849. And the theme that I'm pursuing here is how those who are looking for sort of picturesque historical narratives will turn up different results from those who are studying how to topple governments, for example. I'll try to demonstrate the value of an anarchist approach. We can go to the next slide. This is an art project, a work of conceptual art from 2015 by Ahmet Ogut. He was inspired by this story. He'd heard about Bakunin. I'll read you the text describing this work of conceptual art. In this, he's gone to an art gallery and taken some of the art and made a little barricade inside of the art gallery. And his statement about this, he says, as Prussian troops prepared to crush the 1849 socialist uprising in Dresden, anarchist Mikhail Bakunin proposed that paintings from the National Museum be placed in front of the barricades, reasoning that Prussian soldiers wouldn't dare destroy the works of art to breach their defenses. Inspired by Bakunin's never-realized proposal, the artist has created site-specific barricades featuring works from museum collections. So the myth about Bakunin is that he suggested during the uprising that they should take the paintings out of the museums and put them on the barricades to defend the revolt. This is it's a picturesque myth, it's a picaresque myth, it's a myth in which an anarchist is making a crazy proposal that everybody else is like, no, you know. And it's charming. It's a myth that speaks to anarchists, but also speaks to people who want to make up stories about anarchists, who want to say that anarchists are crazy people or quixotic people or dreamers who don't have any really concrete ideas. And here, in fact, we have an artist saying, well, this is a beautiful myth. We should remember it. I want to make my first correction at this stage, and I read the artist's statement saying that Mikhail Bakunin was an anarchist. Mikhail Bakunin did not identify as an anarchist for almost 20 years after the 1849 uprising in Dresden. Let's go to the next slide. This is the barricade being exhibited in Dresden. We can go to the next one. Okay, and this is Guy Debord, author of The Society of the Spectacle, a famous situationist, and certainly a respected researcher and scholar in many circles. And I was raised by Guy Debord to believe in this myth about Mikhail Bakunin. In Guy Debord's text of 1963, The Situationists and the New Forms of Action in Art and Politics, Guy Debord wrote, and I quote, during the Dresden Uprising of 1849, Bakunin unsuccessfully proposed that the insurgents take the paintings out of the museums and put them on a barricade at the entrance to the city to see if this might inhibit the attacking troops. Okay, so where does this story come from? We'll go to the next slide. This is Alexander Gertsen, another Russian, a colleague and a contemporary of Mikhail Bakunin's, who after the 1849 uprising wrote about it while Bakunin was in prison, you know, sentenced to death in three different countries. And Gertsen was not able to communicate with Bakunin to learn what had happened, actually. So he heard some things. And so he is the source for this story about the art and the barricades. And I'll read to you the paragraph from Gertsen. Bakunin appeared again as a military commandant of Dresden. The former artillery officer, that's Bakunin, taught the art of war to the professors, musicians, and chemists who had taken up arms and advised them to hang Raphael's Madonna on the city walls to protect themselves from the Prussians, who were, you know, too uptight to dare to fire on Raphael's painting. Now, I want to emphasize, Gertsen was not in Dresden. He didn't get to talk with Bakunin about this. And Gertsen, if you read his memoirs, he loves a nice story. Here, I'll read you the next paragraph from his text, just so you understand the kind of stories he's telling about Bakunin. On the way from Paris to Prague, Bakunin ran into a revolt of peasants somewhere in Germany. They were shouting and making an uproar outside a castle, unable to do anything. Bakunin got out of his vehicle and, not having time to figure out what was going on, formed the peasants up into an army and instructed them so well that by the time he got into the carriage again to continue his journey, the castle was on fire. Now, I've also studied what Bakunin did during the journey from Paris to Prague, and there are no other sources confirming this story. You know, it's a charming story. But my point is, Gertsen loves a good story. The good thing about this primary source, or secondary source, we found the source of the myth, and it says which painting it was that was supposed to be on the barricades. We can go to the next one. It was this painting, Raphael's Sistine Madonna. And all right, let's go to the close-up here of the bottom. There we go. You see the cherubs? You've seen these cherubs before, right? These are world-famous cherubs. Anywhere that you're selling a postcard or a coffee cup or something with cherubs on it, it's probably these cherubs. So the story is not just that Bakunin wanted to put a painting on the barricades. The story is that Bakunin wanted to put the original cherubs on the barricades, you know, to endanger the symbol of innocence and vulnerability. Again, an appealing story if you want to have a certain narrative about anarchists. The other thing that this historical detail helps us do is it helps us to identify where it was that painting would have been taken from. Next slide. This is the Johanneum, the art gallery in Dresden for a couple hundred years. I think it was a stables before that. And it was the art gallery in 1849. It's still one, I think. We can go to the next slide. Yeah, here's another picture of it. This is where the Sistine Madonna of Raphael was kept. All right, I'm going to return to that detail in a minute. And we'll go to the next slide. This is a drawing of the town hall in Dresden during the uprising in May 1849. And depicted there, we see the accused leaders of the uprising. Bakunin is sitting at the table with his back to us. The other people he's talking to are the German Democrats, Heubner, Tott, Schirner, and let's see here. All right, so now we get into the primary sources. And I'm going to try to sketch out a story of what actually happened that led to this fairy tale about the paintings and the barricades. First, we'll start with a brief quote from Bakunin himself in his confession to the Tsar. He says, "Heubner and I went to the barricades partly to hearten the fighters and partly to find out at least something about the state of affairs, concerning which no one in the room of the provisional government had the slightest information." So what we hear, you know, Bakunin says nothing about paintings or barricades in his letters, in his confession, in any other memoirs, but he does say that he went to the barricades at one point, at least, during the uprising. And somebody else says something about this same case of Bakunin going to the barricades. It's Richard Wagner, the famous anti-Semite and also sometime classical music composer. His account is also not trustworthy. If you read it and compare it with other sources, he gets the dates wrong. He gets the days of the week wrong. He says all sorts of things that are sort of compromising for himself. And he also, like Gerritsen, he loves a dramatic story about his crazy acquaintance, the Russian revolutionary. Bakunin, for his part, on his deathbed, told his lifelong friend that he never liked Wagner and considered him just a blowhard, you know. But here, all the same, Wagner is a primary source, so I'm going to read Wagner's account of the situation. And again, Wagner doesn't mention anything about people threatening to put paintings on the barricades, but he does mention Bakunin being present at a barricade. And I quote from Wagner, from his My Life. "I came upon Bakunin in the midst of the main group of speakers. He was able to give me an extraordinarily accurate account of what had happened. Information had reached headquarters from a barricade in the Neumarkt, the New Market, in Dresden, where the attack was most serious, the attack from the repressive Prussian troops. Information had reached them that everything was in a state of confusion there before the onslaught of the troops. Thereupon, my friend Marshal von Bieberstein, together with Leo von Lischlinski, who were officers in the Citizen Corps, they were part of the revolt, had called up some volunteers and conducted them to the place of danger, to the barricade. Heubner of Freiburg, one of the leaders of the revolt, without a weapon to defend himself and with bared head, jumped immediately on top of the barricade, which had just been abandoned by all its defenders. He was the sole member of the provisional government to remain on the spot, the leaders Tott and Schirner having disappeared at the first sign of a panic. Heubner turned around to exhort the volunteers to advance, addressing them in stirring words. His success was complete, the barricade was taken again, and gunfire, as unexpected as it was fierce, was directed upon the Prussian troops, which, as I myself saw, were forced to retire. Bakunin had been in close touch with this action, he had followed the volunteers, and he now explained to me that however narrow might be the political views of Hübner, who is a member of the moderate left of the Saxon Chamber of Representatives, Hübner was a man of noble character at whose service he had immediately placed his own life. So if you will, for later, remember this image of Hübner and Bakunin going to a barricade in the Neumarkt, the new market that is under fire. All right, now fortunately we have more precise sources than these people. So go to the next slide. I went back and I read the report of the Prussian military commander who led the repression of the revolt in Dresden. And Friedrich von Waldersee, there we go. The Prussian officer who commanded the military operation. He's made this lovely map for us, and you can't see it as well as I'd like you to be able to, but every single barricade that they fought against is marked on the map. And there's a color code, which is the locations are numbered. You can see them on the right. There's a color coding system where he shows which parts of the city they captured every day. So let's go to the next slide. This is a close-up. And that's the Neumarkt. You can see it in the middle. I'm actually going to have to go in front of the live stream, unfortunately. This is the art gallery, the Johanneum, that I explained to you before, number 15. And here's the Neumarkt, where the fighting was. Here's the Große Frauenstrasse, where there's two barricades facing the art gallery, the Johanneum. And the color coding is set up so that you can see that on May 4, the troops occupied the blue areas. On May 5, the troops occupied the yellow areas. And on May 6, they occupied the red areas. So you can see how the troops, day by day, expanded their region of control. All right, so you see where the art gallery is. You see the barricade right across from it. Okay, let's go to the next one. I'm going to read to you from the report of Friedrich von Waldersee. He says, overnight, beginning on May 4th, according to him, the body infantry regiment occupied the Brühl Palace, which dominated the terrace of the same name. The Prince Albert Regiment used the connection leading from the castle through the rifle gallery to the picture gallery. That's the Johanneum, the art gallery, which, of course, had to be opened by breaking a door that had been locked for years, in order to win and maintain the square dominating the north side of the Neumarkt, like a projecting bastion, and from there to bombard the tall buildings on the three other sides of the square, which were occupied by the insurgents. And the Prussian commander adds a footnote, the occupants of the space dedicated to art had tried to secure themselves, as everywhere, by blankets and mattresses, which, however, were penetrated by bullets in the vicinity of the enemy, so that some dead and several wounded fell on this point. By occupants, he doesn't mean the insurgents. He means the soldiers that were part of his army. So what we see here actually is that, here we'll go back to the map on the previous, here we go. What we see here is that it was in fact at the beginning of the repression of the uprising, what happened was that Prussian soldiers came from the palace, broke into the art gallery from behind it, you know, brought in mattresses and secured themselves in the art gallery, and from there began shooting upon the rebels. And in fact, if you just go to the Wikipedia entry for the Johanneum, it says, during the Dresden uprising in May 1849, the building was severely damaged by shelling. Many of the valuable pictures were also shot through. Let's go to the next slide here. Okay. Now this is this is by an embedded reporter. It's a drawing of the fighting in the Neumarkt. In fact, the subtitle, which you probably can't see, says, Barricade in the Große Frauenstrasse attacked from the Neumarkt. This is the barricade fighting that was happening where the insurgents were being fired upon from the art gallery. The art gallery is off screen to the, well, to your left. The person standing on the barricade is pointing at it. And you can see that that's the church spire there that helps locate everything. Is this an image of Bakunin and Hoibner at the barricade? I don't know. I mean, you can compare the depictions of these people to the depictions in the picture from the town hall that I showed you earlier, but we don't know the answer to that. But what all this offers is a completely different depiction of the events. In the popular mythologized narrative, an anarchist threatened the paintings, claiming that soldiers were afraid to shoot them. And everybody from Bakunin's friend, Gerson, to supposed intellectuals like Guy Debord, to contemporary artists, has reproduced this tale. And it's easy to understand why. It's picturesque. It represents the anarchist as a sort of a zany extremist, being an extremist, whether in the service of liberty or simply pure violence. But in fact, the story was the opposite way around. It was soldiers loyal to the king who broke into the art gallery and fired on Bakunin and other people from behind the paintings without being afraid of what would happen to them. The institutions of art were not threatened. Rather, they were the fortification from which the reactionary troops fired on the proponents of social change. At the time, Bakunin did not identify as an anarchist, although the experience may have helped him to become one. So why is this important? Why is it important that rather than trying to put paintings on barricades, it was soldiers firing from behind the barricades at the rebels? For me, the reason that this relates to an anarchist analysis is that first, when we make decisions in our social movements, our decisions should be informed by the facts, and truth is often stranger than fiction, right? Truth is more surprising than fiction. It's easy to stop when you have a nice narrative, but the narrative may not actually depict the course of events. And in this example, at least, it's for me, it seems very significant that it was not an anarchist trying to, you know, threatening the institutions of art, and it was not soldiers who respected art, but that it was the institutions of art were the place from which the violence was occurring to the rebels. And now I'll cede the floor to my colleague who will tell another story about anarchist history.
Hello. Hi. How you doing? I'm sorry so many of you are on the floor, but I don't think there's any more chairs. There's one chair here if anyone wants to sit in it. Hello. So, many of us are very passionate about anarchist history. When I was becoming an anarchist, it was reading about Bakunin, reading about Kropotkin and his escape from prison, reading about Nestor Makhno and in Ukraine, and reading all these sorts of things that were inspiring and suggested to me that different worlds could be possible, and that the historical stories that I grew up learning in school and stuff like that weren't the entire story. So on a personal level, it seems very obvious to me, but I'm also a nerd. I don't know whether anyone else cares about this. I don't know whether it's important for our movements. So as I followed this passion and started to think more about it, I came up with some questions that I don't necessarily have answers to, but I want to know what other people think and what answers you have, what other new questions you have about how history and history research, like what we've just heard, can help us dismantle all forms of hierarchy and domination and create a free world. So, one more. So I'm going to tell a story. I have a long-term research project about the history of queer and trans anarchisms in the North American territory. When I was growing, it's very different now. If you look around Centimia today, like, you will see it's very different. But when I was growing up as a young anarchist, it was not a very queer movement. Gender norms tended to be a little bit more rigid. Relationships tended to be a little bit more conventional. That's changed a lot in recent years. So the things that I started to research on queer and trans anarchisms were very obscure and kind of niche when I started, but now many people are interested in them, so that's cool. So I want to tell a little story about trans history and how it connects to anarchism, and just a tiny little story that will open up some bigger questions about what those of us who care about history might think could be useful for research and writing and study in our movements today. So the person on the screen is a person named Dr. Alan Hart. He is pretty well known in queer and trans history in the US because he was the first trans man to receive a gender-confirming surgery in the United States. This was in 1917-18. And this was decades before people like Christine Jorgensen, who were seen as like the first trans celebrities or the first trans surgeries. And he was very distinctive because he was raised as a woman in the Northwest United States, identified very strongly with masculine pursuits and masculine dress, fell in love with women, but didn't have any models available for how he could express himself in this way. He studied to become a doctor, and he got a medical degree at a women's medical college. And so he knew a lot about health and bodies and surgery and things like this. And in 1917, he sort of in desperation, trying to figure out what he could do to live a life in his body that would feel good and enable him to be who he was, he went to a doctor and said, "Look, I want you to give me this kind of surgery. I know exactly what I want. Here's how you do it. Here's my justification. Do this for me." No one had ever done this before, to our knowledge, so long as we know. Of course, many people had lived lives where they crossed gender, you know, dressing in different ways or performing roles outside of their expectations. But so far as we know, in the United States, no one had ever done this before, gone to a doctor demanding that a doctor give them the medical support that they needed to live in their body in the way that they wanted to. So the doctor said, okay, and agreed to perform a series of surgeries. And so Dr. Hart in 1918 began living as a man and did so for the rest of his life. He was outed, he was exposed as being transgender at several times in his life and had to leave communities and start in new places. He married two different women at different times in his life. He became actually a very well-known researcher about tuberculosis and created this new method of diagnosing tuberculosis that saved thousands of lives in the United States, and also wrote novels, kind of weird, kind of queer, kind of sci-fi like novels as well. Lived a very interesting life. Anyway, so what does this have to do with anarchist history? He's a very well-known person in trans history in the US, but what not so many people know is that if you read the main source that we have for information about his early life, which is a report written by a doctor who sort of saw him as a patient when he was planning his transition, it's located in this book, Gay American History. It's a collection of sources about early queer and trans history. We get this very interesting detail where it says, in 1916, as he is sort of in desperation trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life, he's in love with this woman and she's in love with him, but the relationship is understood as a lesbian relationship or a same-sex relationship, which is forbidden in the places where he lives. It says, in the summer of 1916, he goes traveling to another city for work. While in this city, H, that's Dr. Hart, heard many lectures by Emma Goldman and became much interested in anarchism. There's this fascinating little detail, because just barely a year later, after hearing Emma Goldman give lectures and getting interested in anarchism, he does something that no one has ever done before in the United States. He takes control of his own life, his own body, his own gender, and demands from a doctor to get a kind of surgery that had never been done before to support trans people in living in their identity. So is this just a random detail? Is this just a coincidence? I don't think so. So Emma Goldman, as probably everyone here has heard this name, famous anarchist agitator who in the United States from the 1890s until she was deported in 1919, gave many, many thousands of lectures on anarchism, on labor, on culture and drama and arts. And she also lectured on sexuality and gender and relationships. She was the first person, so far as we know, in the United States to give political lectures about homosexuality that were supportive, that were positive. And Dr. Hart saw one of these lectures. And at this time, literally, and I'm not just saying this because I'm an anarchist and a partisan, literally no one in the United States was speaking publicly in a positive way about same-sex sexuality or gender nonconformity in the way that anarchists were. Anarchists were the first people in the United States to express public support and political support for people to live their sexualities and their genders in the ways that they wanted to. And Dr. Hart, hearing one of these lectures, would be hearing something that was totally outside of the political and social norms of the United States at this time. Emma Goldman's long-term comrade and sometimes lover, Alexander Berkman on the right, who was incarcerated for many years for attempting to assassinate an industrialist who was responsible for a massacre of workers, while in prison, wrote his prison memoirs. And in the prison memoirs, published in 1912, I think, spoke about sexuality between the male prisoners in a way that was sympathetic. And again, this was the first book that circulated publicly on the left and in radical circles that acknowledged homosexuality and didn't condemn it, didn't speak badly about it. So the anarchist movement at this time was one of the only places where people whose sexuality and whose gender clashed with social norms could experience some kind of support, and not just sympathy or pity, but a political analysis, a sense that it wasn't a problem with you as an individual, but with the society that creates oppressive norms that narrow who we can become. So, in that sense, when we think about the story of Dr. Alan Hart, and we think about the lectures of Emma Goldman he attended, we think about his interest in anarchism, and we think then about how he did something that no one had ever done in the United States before, decades before transsexual surgeries became available to other people, before there was hormone replacement therapy available, before all of these things. This brings up some questions for me, and it ties into bigger questions about anarchist history. So why is it important to bring this into the story? Why is it important to think about the significance of anarchism, of anarchist speakers, of propaganda networks, the ways that anarchists were speaking about topics that no one else would speak about, that were taboo in the broader culture? Why is that important? And why is it important to our movements now and the ways that we think about strategy? So on that note, I want to think about, oh, well, I'll come back to that. All right. Well, okay, don't read all of these at once. Just, we'll go one at a time. So I was trying to answer this question, like, why do I do history? Why do I care? Why, as an anarchist, and to be clear, when I say an anarchist historian, I don't mean someone who writes history about the history of anarchists. I mean someone who has devoted my life to the abolition of all forms of hierarchy and domination and the creation of a horizontal society where we can all live freely today, forever. That's what I mean. To be clear. So, why, as an anarchist historian, could it be useful to our movements today? And I thought about all the reasons why people give, like, oh, well, you know, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it, and these sorts of weird slogans we say about why it's, you know, it's good to know history. I don't really care about those so much. I don't know if they're so accurate. I want to think more specifically for us as anarchists, not just in a general way, for people who want to completely transform the world that we live in. So one reason could just be emotional. It feels really good to have a usable past, to be able to look back at people and be like, yes, Bakunin was on those barricades and not, you know, threatening paintings, but like defying. Yeah, it gives us a sense of resonance in our hearts emotionally with the people in the past in this tradition. That can be important. That can fortify us for the struggles that that we face. Or what about a sense of identity, a sense of continuity? So There have always been anarchists, or at least, depending on how we define it, for the last 150, 200 years. So what were anarchists doing in Saint-Imier in 1873? Well, I was just reading earlier today the program that, or the proposals that were passed by some of the folks at Saint-Imier 150 years ago. And let me tell you, they are fucking relevant to this day. They are really helpful. And they gave me a sense of like, wow, I am a part of this long line of people who I can look back to and feel like I, in some small way, am trying to carry on their legacy, and I can be proud of that. So a sense of continuity that we, you know, that our movement wasn't just born in the anti-globalization era, it didn't just come out of punk, but that we have these long traditions that we can identify with. Or we might think about history as a way to diagnose or explain things, like what went wrong? Why, you know, in Paris in 1968, like why didn't the government fall? Why did we lose the Spanish Civil War? Why, you know, all these sorts of questions in these moments that we debate over and over to try to diagnose things and come up with better explanations than we have from most of the histories that are written by people who are not anarchists or who are hostile to anarchism. Similarly, as a form of justification, and when I say apology here, I don't mean like saying I'm sorry. I mean sort of like an apology, like a sort of a like an explanation that you know, justifies why we do things. Like, why do we break windows? Why did some anarchists think that propaganda by the deed tactics made sense 100, 120 years ago? Why do anarchists do all sorts of things that seem strange to people in other movements? Well, it's not just, I don't know. Perhaps it's because there are historical reasons that we've seen many times that some of the strategies that are more popular in left movements or electoral movements or among liberals don't seem to work and have negative consequences and, you know, reinforce hierarchies and authority. So that can be another reason. It could also, related to these, be tactical and strategic. So when we look at really detailed histories, maps of barricades and things like that, how could we do this differently? This can happen in, you know, on the level of a city when we are at demonstrations together and we look at what happened and what went wrong and we think about how can we change our tactics, how can we adapt them to get around the police next time. Doing this on the scale of decades or hundreds of years, that can also be helpful. Not just in terms of sort of specific tactics of demonstrations, but also big strategies. Did it make sense for some anarchists to join the government in you know, Republican Spain in 1936, 1937? Or was that a famous mistake? You know, what sorts of strategies should we use to think about the opportunities that we have today? Another thing, to emphasize contingency. By this I mean that things didn't have to be the way they are. So a lot of history that I read seems to be based on the idea that we live in the only possible world that we could live in, and what history is just sort of explaining why this is the only world we could live in. As an anarchist, I am opposed to this. So, why is it that we live in this world? Not because it's the only possible world, but because there are a million other possible worlds. And if we had made different choices then, if we make different choices today, we could live in any number of different worlds. So maybe history can give us some insight into that, to show us the ways that at important moments, that if we had gone down different paths, if we had made different choices, maybe things could have been different. And finally, maybe it's just because we're nerds. Maybe I just love history. Maybe it's just a passion, and maybe that's okay. Maybe what I want, in part, out of a life of being an anarchist is to be able to do what I love and what's dear to my heart. And that can be a reason in itself. I don't know. Does this convince you? Do you feel like some of these, all of these, maybe, who knows? This is not an exhaustive list. We could come up with more, right? But I wanted to name all of these things out because all of us who do research, who do history, who do writing, we come to it with different ideas about what it's for. But if we're only doing it because it's a passion, or we're only doing it because we think it's important to know what anarchists did back then, we might not think about all the different ways that it can be useful. And thinking about why we're doing it, what it's useful for, might change the different approaches that we use. What archives do we look at? What audiences do we write for? What kinds of spaces or media do we present our history in? Are we writing books? Are we making documentaries? Are we making TikTok videos? Who are we trying to reach? What is it for? And, so coming back to Dr. Alan Hart, right? So this one man living in the 1910s, 1920s in the United States, who saw Emma Goldman lecture and through anarchist ideas was able to imagine possibilities for his life that he'd never imagined before, and took self-determination over his body, his life, his health, and created a new way of being in the world. I think this story is important, not just because it's like, look, anarchists were first at something, but more so because when Emma Goldman was making those speeches, she didn't know who was in the audience. She didn't know what the consequences would be that would ripple out for years, for decades to come. She didn't know that 100 years later today, anti-transgender politics would be one of the most important right-wing movements that we have to struggle against today. She didn't know any of these things. She didn't know that there would be a young person there who would hear her speech and use the tools that she offered, the anarchist tools that she used to think about life, the body, politics, gender differently, to do something that no one had ever done before. And I think about that when I think about the movements that we're a part of today. If we only think about the strength of the anarchist movement in terms of the numbers of people who wave a black flag or show up at demonstrations, yes, at least in the United States where I live, we are not a large movement. We do not seem that powerful. But when I think about the influence that we have with our ideas, with our tactics, with the examples that we set, and I look at that over the course of history, and I look at the ways that anarchist proposals, anarchist experiments with new forms of freedom have been incredibly influential, way out of proportion to the number of people who ever called themselves anarchists. And we can see this in so many ways where the state and capitalist corporations appropriate new ideas that anarchists come up with to their own purposes. Think about everything from free bicycle programs to mutual aid efforts to Twitter. All projects that originally had their roots in anarchist initiatives that have then been reclaimed. But when we go back into some of these other histories, like Dr. Alan Hart, we can also see that it's not always so immediate. Like sometimes it takes literally decades. Alan Hart did something inspired by Emma Goldman, inspired by the freedom that anarchist perspectives enabled this person to have, to do something that only decades later we would realize was such an important new way of thinking about the body and gender and identity in our society. And so I think one of the potentials that history has for us is to see on this longer scale the way that the tiny little things that we do today, the experiments that we do with tactics and strategy, the new relations that we form with each other, the projects and the infrastructure that we create, the ideas that we come up with and the texts that we circulate have a power and a resonance that go way beyond any standard historical idea of victories and losses and numbers and things like this. And to me, that gives me a sense that even when I feel discouraged and disillusioned, even when I feel alienated on the left and everywhere else, even when I worry that everything I've ever done as an anarchist is meaningless, and I feel that way sometimes, I don't know if you do, even when I feel those ways, I can look back at these histories and I can see, oh, if we look at this in a longer arc, we are so much more powerful than we realize. We have a capacity to transform this world so powerfully, not necessarily in the ways that we hope, but we have a capacity to shake things up, to challenge norms, to liberate the lives of individual people and collectives. Again, not alone, not like we have all the best ideas and no one else has come up with anything good, but in conjunction with all of these other ideas and struggles that we participate in and that we contribute to. And when we look at this over a long period of time, we can see that even a small number of anarchists have completely transformed the path that our societies have taken over the last 150 or 200 years. And to me, that's what I take from anarchist history. That's what feels so powerful and important to me today, to do these researches. So, this is a collage of some of the people who are a part of the Queer and Trans Anarchist History Project that I'm finishing. Some of them are famous, some of them no one has ever heard of, but there are just like so many fascinating stories about people who, like Dr. Alan Hart, used the tools that anarchism offered to transform sexuality, gender, the body, and society in ways that not only transformed their lives as individuals, but years or decades later, pushed the society as a whole in ways that we're only just starting to see today. So when you look around at Saint-Imier today and you see so many queer and trans people, so much exploration of gender, so many conflicts over how we talk about all of these things, this didn't just start in the last 10 years. All of these people have been sowing these seeds for 100 years or more of defiance, of experimentation and creativity. And that, I think, is something that anarchist history can offer to us, is that confidence that the experiments that we take today, the seeds that we're sowing today, will contribute to freedom for many, many generations to come. So that's what I had to say.
We still have some time here, so my hope is that that other people who are engaged in historical research, if you want to speak up and just say what it is you're working on in case somebody else in the room wants a colleague, right? You can also ask us questions about the things we've said or fact check our efforts. There's a microphone right there. Is there anybody who'd like to go first? All of you came to an anarchist history thing, but you are not historians yourselves. You're all historians, actually, you know? I mean, yeah. Do you want to take the mic? Sorry, for the sake of the...
I'm not a historian, but I've got a question kind of about, I guess, crime think in general and how they regard history and a kind of perspective from the collective, because it seems like it's changed a lot over the last 20 years, especially thinking back to Days of War and Nights of Love, and some of the factoids in the book being sometimes a bit strange, like in regards to Fume and the history of kind of anarchism and fascism, and just wondering how the collective views history today. So.
Well, speaking about the Crime Think Collective, many different strategies, approaches, and ideas coexist inside of this network today as 25 years ago. You're speaking of the little history snippets in Days of War, Nights of Love, which are provocative and intended not so much to present an objective view of history as to confrontationally undermine the notion that there is an objectivity in history. Which is a different project than writing a dry history book, you know? Now, it's also true that when a group of people are young and rebellious, they might, you know, confrontationally oppose some terrible institution, and then you get older. I probably shouldn't co-quote this Clash lyric about, No, it's the he who does something bad with nuns will one day join the church. That's all I'll say. But if you look into the abyss looks back at you, right? Like, you know, one moment you're a 20-something person being like, I just read Nietzsche's, you know, on the use and uses and abuse of history for life, and I'm suspicious of history as a framework, you know. And the next moment, you turn around, several decades have passed, and you're like, you, flipping through like a dusty tome, trying to read old German, you know. I want to affirm, to answer your question, I want to affirm both an anti-authoritarian and sort of pugnacious or like a provocative approach to the like old masters of history and the idea of an objective history and the question of who it is that gets to write that history and how we relate to it. And I also want to say the practice of memory is essential to our efforts to struggle against those institutions. I don't know if that answers your question, but we'll spend the rest of our lives trying to. Can you get the mic? It's on the table.
Yeah, about the question which work I'm doing concerning history, since like a few years I'm starting to really think about left history in Germany, which is not anarchist, and there's not like an anarchist history told. That's like in other places you have like people tolling generation after generation, giving some knowledge back, and in Germany the anarchist movement for a long time was too small for that. And for me it's connecting to the points you had earlier, it's one part of a healing movement, a healing work, because like German society is so statist and the left is so statist, and also giving people the idea about what like the left did to anarchists in Europe. Like, I think it's very important to reconnect and start telling your own history. And so if people interested in from Germany or German speaking world to connect, learning about our history of anarchists in German speaking countries, especially Germany, or like how we can tell the history of the left from an anarchist view and connect it to like the things happening in the UdSSR, for example. just contact me after the thing. And I think it's important to have our own history, not in a sense that's the true history, but a history of searching truth, and also to have a living culture, because if we don't have a culture that's separated from status history, then our struggles will always end in reproducing the faults of the past.
I'm not sure if the mic cord can reach there.
Speaking to that, thank you. Yeah, we have in Berlin, I turn around so you can see me, talk to me later or contact us, that we have a historical, if you want, if you will, initiative in Berlin. It's called Gustav Landauer Initiative in Berlin. And we're doing exactly that. We are kind of a lot of different kind of things. Like anarchism in Berlin, which is really the genus loci of like anarchism, like taking off in Germany in the early 1890s, is not in public conscious at all. So we're trying to do that by different means, like a memorial initiative, most prominent one for Gustav Landauer, an exhibition. We could do guided tours of anarchist Berlin, historical Berlin, have a series of brochures. There's some stuff at the Graswurzel Revolution, a stand that we brought. Also, there's the in French, the Landauer exhibition that's in German, and we have one in French. And we try to capture digitally a lot of the kind of like brittle, rare papers and brochures, you know. And when they're gone, they're gone. And all of this kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of interesting stuff to discover. And like everything we think has a long history, you know. And we don't like it's not that we start thinking with our birth, but like we're born into a context and like adopt all of these. Concepts, and it's good to know their to understand them by understanding how they got generated. Like, I mean, and open up a space for.
There's a hand over there.
Do you have like a website?
Yeah, fully. If you look at Gustav Landauer Initiative Berlin, get in touch. We do we even a member organization in some way. We have monthly meetings. I don't know what to do.
So I wanted to have a female voice. Thank you very much for the presentation. I think that content that we create grows. We grow, content grows. But I wanted to thank you my English is so bad. the whole collective, because the last 25 years, crime think texts and brochures and all these little snippets, no matter if provocative or deep inside research stuff, mobilized so many people. I'm from Swiss Germany. Swiss Germany. And yeah. Okay. Okay, but it's like we went in the book to the book fair yesterday, and some young 19-year-old guy. Yeah, that's why we are anarchists. They pointed at brochures from Crime Think, and I remember I'm almost 40 now, and I remember that I also I was really influenced by this. Long story short, I'm a historian. I'm a teacher in history and philosophy, and the kids I teach are not anarchists. I can't teach only anarchist history, and that's also not something that I want, because I try to have and sometimes another perspective that destroys a little bit the opinion they hear from their parents or stuff or from the media. But I think what is great and what I want to do, and I think you do it, is to have, like you said earlier, that the truth, the reality is more, gives us more than the myth. And it's real. They watch Netflix, they watch, I don't know, action films, but when I tell them about history, about specific things, they are all really in, what the fuck, humanity, what, grown people did that? And that's important. I think also if it's, that objectivity doesn't exist, and I don't want to teach fake stuff, but I can tell the truth in little bits and interesting, and that's I think it's important. Not this big old proton blah blah.
Thank you. Also thank you from me for this very nice presentation. And my question is, what do you think about the role of self-reflection as a person who writes history? Because, for example, I have history and philosophy classes, and we also learned, of course, about history not being objective but being subjective. But there is also some sort of issue. For example, when I write, I try to be as inclusive as possible, but I know also that I have, for example, internalized capitalism and patriarchy, and I really don't want to put it in, but sometimes, it happens automatically. So I wanted to ask you, do you have any tips or any recommendations how to,
I think one of the useful things about being in a collective is that it's very different from the isolated academic world where so much is individual and you're supposed to sort of copyright your own work and not plagiarize from anybody, and you have advice from mentors or whatever, but I think the way that I have grown the most is just by doing talks and public presentations where I get feedback and criticism from people, by sharing drafts with people in collectives and reading groups and things like this, because there will always be things that, based on my own experience and what my own limits are and the things that I don't know that I won't understand. And also recognizing that Even a topic as specific as the one that I want to work on, you could write a totally different queer and trans anarchist history of the territory of the United States, and figuring out how to have relationships of solidarity with people doing other research projects, recognizing that the way that you tell the story will be strong and powerful and different from the way that I will tell the story. And we will all contribute to stronger movements by having many different voices doing that. So I think both in our own projects, sort of doing them as collectively as possible, getting criticism and feedback, and not just from other historians and writers, but from big rooms like this. And then, yeah, supporting with resources, with feedback, with sharing archives, sharing sources and interviews, things like this, other people who are working on projects that are kind of parallel. That's what I would say.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was really, really helpful.
Hey, appreciate the presentation. Hello again. Nice to see you after so many years. I think looking into history can help us and should help us to inform our strategy, because we can look into patterns, and I believe we should do that more, which had happened in past or which been happening at present in different places in the world, and make them to inform, are we actually repeating the same thing? Because I agree, we are very powerful as movement, as bringing ideas. On the other hand, us anarchists, let's be honest, we aren't winning right now. And in fact, we are stuck in a circle for a few decades. That's me being said as anarchist, I'm not coming from like, you know, some trying to like infiltrate a crowd. Actually, I think that's a self-reflection. And we can look on how there is like a fragility in movement and inability to step into contradiction and complexities. One of a great anarchistic part of, you know, when we talk about projects, we can see how the very strong animal liberation movement, where it is now and where it's, you know, all the vegan market, and how is that liberating anyone? How many identities we have on shelves, but are actually people much happier, or they feel like more empowered as like revolutionary movement to greater goals, including the gender struggle. But we can go farther. We can look on open source movement, which I think is a great example of, again, perhaps not anarchist per identity, but a great decentralized project happening all around the world, which by large turned into capitalist dystopia. All the open source code is used by Google, is used by Apple, and is used by these companies. So my question is, for the discussion, I might not be answering that right now, but like how we can use history of our own movements and of another movements and not be also scared to look even in our adversaries. You can learn things from ISIS if you wish. Negative things, but also their successes. To step out of that circle and step out of like, we do projects, but then there may be more too successful, or the statist forces or liberalism taking over, and then we don't know how to deal with the complexity. So we step out and actually leave all that value and leave all of those ideas. And then we either are depressed or we pat our back that, hey, look, but we are powerful, our ideas made it out there. But if our ideas make it in a way that it is not liberating the world and it's not creating the world towards the aims we've had, or did we have any, then it's actually not success. So I want to acknowledge the power we might have, but I also want to see how history can help us to enter contradictions, enter complexities, and figure out towards which aims we're doing, what path it takes and what form it takes, which I think is often missing, because there is need to be sort of coordination, which I think history can teach us as well.
Does somebody want to speak to this? This is not exactly an answer to your question, but I'll give an example of how to use history as a weapon. Just a very simple example from my own experience. In the small town that I come from in the United States, there is the biggest statue, really the only big statue in the town, was a Confederate monument, a monument to the people who fought to preserve slavery in the South. And the monument was a source of emotional violence for all of the black people in this town. And nobody else really paid attention to it. And a single historian, everyone else says, you know, it's just a monument, it's about history. But a single historian did a little bit of research about the monument and turned up the speech that was made when the monument was first installed, and it was a speech from a person promoting anti-black violence, a promoter of the Ku Klux Klan, and using this speech was able to show the historical violence represented by the statue in a way that no one could avoid, and motivated in large part by this narrative, a crowd of people were able to understand the value of going to the statue, tearing it down, and defending the space so the police were never able to put it back. So this is you know, the protagonist of that struggle is the crowd that carried out the action. But the historian played a crucial role in offering a point of departure for this action. And you're talking about all the ways that we can develop tactics, we can develop strategies, and then they can be co-opted. At the minimum, a history of co-optation will show us the risks, a history of specific incidents of co-optation. And then the other thing that we can do is to learn from examples in the past, but also to stick around in the movements. Some of you are probably enthusiastic young anarchists. You, more of you are like anarchist adults from what I can see, you know? It's easy as you get older to be like, well, we tried this thing, it was exhausting, we accomplished something, I'm kind of tired. I think that we have a responsibility to stay in movements even when at some point we will be older than most of the people around us, because the new generations of people will need access to our historical memory. In the United States, it's very hard to maintain intergenerational connections. But a comrade of mine who spent a little bit of time in Italy and came back to tell us about this, you know, he said, oh yeah, I was at this meeting, this anarchist group. You know, most people are like 25 years old, you know, and then there's a couple people that are like in their 70s, you know, and the people in their 70s are just asleep at the meeting, you know, but at some point near the end of the meeting, you can wake them up and say, oh yeah, you know, like we arrived at an agreement to, you know, to have the demonstration at the city gate. You know, did you ever try that, you know, uncle? And the old anarchist can say, yeah, we did that in 1979. And the thing is that if you don't block the alley, the police can come through it and surround you. Like that historical memory is crucial. And each of us, by staying involved in projects, by staying connected to people younger than us, can pass that on to the people who come after us to keep fighting, the young people that you're with, you know, young anarchists, so that our movements will be equipped. That's a way that each person can be a historian and can be a source of powerful historical memory, making movements stronger.
And just to say another word about that, it's interesting to see different anarchist cultures in different territories who have different cultures of memory and different cultures of history and storytelling. I feel inspired by Chilean comrades who have a very strong culture of remembering anarchists killed by police in demonstrations and in art and graffiti and in other things. I feel inspired by oral history projects where people collect stories from elders and put them in archives or keep them in places where comrades can access them. I feel inspired by I was traveling through Italy to come here from the last anarchist book fair, and I stopped at the memorial to Gaetano Bresci, who was an Italian-American anarchist who assassinated the King of Italy. And there's a massive monument to him. And also in the same cemetery, a section of anarchists, like an anarchist burial plot in the cemetery, where many other people who were involved in the movement have their remains and stones and information about them. So I think it's also useful to talk to your, when we're in a place like this, a gathering like this, to talk to your comrades from other territories and see what they are doing for collective memory to tell their own histories and preserve them. Because we can learn so much, not just from each other's histories, but from each other's methods of thinking about history and preserving them and telling them. And
So that's something that I want to learn from all of you as well, is not only tell me the history of your movement in your territory, but tell me how you remember it, how you commemorate it, how you celebrate it, and how you share it with each other.
We should probably tie up pretty soon so that people can go to the next event. So who still wishes to speak? Put your hand up now. One person? Two? Okay. Yeah. Okay, the two of you and you, did you have a direct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so we'll start with you, and then we'll go to the two of you, and then we'll finish. Yeah,
I just wanted to say, I think the practice of remembering is very different with the regions, but we have something in common, and that we have to think about that and not forget. We are often clandestine. We don't write our diaries and put it on a block and everyone can read our story and our practice and our tactics and everything. So you have to grow into a family or a collective to know how we used to live in a squatted house and how you organize meetings and stuff. And I think this is why it's important to talk to overgenerational, to talk to everyone and not be clandestine, we are so anonymous, new people, we don't talk to them, I don't know. We should not forget that some people do this work. It's not the work that 16-year-old action-loving riot guys want to do, but there are people writing books, paying for these cemeteries and stuff. And also, if it's not that romantic action style, it's very important, really, really important.
Yeah, first off, I want to thank you for your talk. It was really nice. But one thing I think I want to add a bit, like, for an anarchist history, there seems to me, like you said already, normally it's surrounds on masses history and so on. And now, like, you talked about a lot of human history, so it's a lot of human-centered. And for me, it feels like we also should think and analyze how non-human are also treated. And because, like, for example, Marjorie Spiegel pointed out, like, the arguments of how chickens are being treated and objectified and so on are similar to other projects, like when how slaves are being treated. Not to say that it's a similar discrimination, but the arguments are very similar, and it's probably necessary to look at that. And I wanted just to point out that we should not only look on anarchists as humans, but also, like, in generally how we see the environment and other species as well.
Yeah. Two small points. I think also for young people here, or like people between being young and being old, like me, it's important if you have, also if you don't have any anarchist structures anymore in your city, or they're very weak, or you don't hear from them, or you build, in Germany it's often like other left groups control the history in your city, go and search for your comrades from the older times, from the 80s, from the 70s, and talk about them, what happened to the movement there, and analyze it, and just don't do all this big history, only do your local history, because what I learned from researching history in my town is that there always was like a leftist move from different kinds of to, like, put the anarchists and a more autonomous struggle to the side. And you can still see it today, and the structures today are coming from the past. So use that and do this work. And then also, we should get back more, to an internationalist, anti-nationalist anarchist connection. I heard in the Sankt Emir talk yesterday that they had a very strong connection internationally, much more than today maybe. And history offers us it too, because we can't understand the anarchist movement in one part of the world sometimes, of the anarchist movement in the rest of the world, and also history in general. Like, In Germany, I can't understand what happened in Germany without understanding what happened in Russia during the Russian Revolution, because it influenced Germany so much. But I also can't understand maybe the Russian happenings in Russia without understanding German social democratic system and why the anarchists and how they were put out of the German struggles in the 19th century. So see history also as an opportunity to connect not just in your area of language or the country that's claiming your territory, but internationally.
I think we have so many more discussions to have today and tomorrow, so I suggest that we shift from this formal structure to a more informal structure, but I encourage you to speak with each other if someone said something interesting or if you're curious what someone thinks, and you can also approach us. And the last thing I want to say is that you were saying it can be valuable to approach the older people who experience something, and the other thing that history offers me is comrades who have been dead for a long time, but who can still be at our side in our struggles. And it's meaningful to me when the one of the nights that I was in jail to be in there not just by myself but with many other anarchists who had spoken to me from their experiences in jail, and with many other people who have participated in courageous lifelong struggles, and those people can also be your companions and can speak to you, whether they're people who have recently passed away in our movement whose memories we carry forward, people we knew, or people who have been dead for 100 years but whose courage and whose good ideas in the way that they confronted different challenges than we confront now can continue to inspire us and show us what we are capable of ourselves. So thank you so much for being with us, and I'm excited about all the things that we can do together.